Good morning. Welcome to the Greater Minnesota Daily Newspaper Conference Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode until the question and answer session. At the request of the State of Minnesota, this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce your moderator, Governor Tim Pawlenty.
Well, good morning, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call. And we're available to take your questions in just a few moments on any topic. I thought I might just start the call by giving you a update on the legislative session and some of the more recent developments or initiatives at the Capitol. As you know, we are engaged in end-of-session negotiations. Those are taking place as we speak. They went in well into the evening last night, have restarted again this morning, and significant progress has been made. There is no deal yet. The outlines of a deal are somewhat taking form, but it would be premature to report or say that a deal has been struck. If an agreement is reached sometime today or tomorrow, just hypothetically, we would try to get as many bills done in conference committee form by Monday midnight, and then any remaining matters would have to spill into a special session thereafter, hopefully concluding by the end of next week. But again, that's all just hypothetical at this point. I'm not suggesting that that's what's going to happen. The situation is still not finalized. Negotiations are still underway. In terms of some of the more recent issues that have come up at the legislature, maybe I'll just comment on a few of those, and then we'll throw open the lines for questions. The first is we had an initiative this week on all-terrain vehicles, ATVs, or off-highway vehicles, OHVs. And these are, of course, important to Minnesota for a whole bunch of reasons. We have in Articat and Polaris and others, people who are significant economic contributors and job providers in Minnesota who are an important part of that industry. ATV ridership has skyrocketed as people are using it recreationally, hunting for vocational reasons as well. And so the number of ATVs has skyrocketed. And, of course, the other side of the coin is the environmental impacts and degradation that they can cause. And there's been great concern about that. There's about 8,000 miles or estimated up to 8,000 miles of lawful but undesignated trails in Minnesota. There's about 950 designated trails in Minnesota, 950 miles. And so we put together a proposal this week that we have met with legislative authors and leaders on this. We hope to forge a compromise that would have as a policy getting ATVs on managed designated trails, having the DNR do a trail-by-trail or forest-by-forest review and going through and designating the trails and closing trails that are inappropriate environmentally and designating trails that would be appropriate environmentally. We think the net result of that would be to have a sufficient number of trails to accommodate ATV riders but contain them into areas that would be environmentally appropriate. Beyond ATVs, we had a big bioscience summit in Minneapolis this past Monday. We thought we'd get a couple hundred people. We had 600 people and had to turn people away. People were coming and trying to get in at the last minute. We were very pleased with the turnout. This is a really important initiative for the future of Minnesota. The results or importance of it may not be immediately obvious to folks, but over the years and decades, I think they will appreciate the important role and good position that Minnesota could have on this with the right leadership and commitment. And it takes many forms. A lot of people just think it's human health or it's health at the University of Minnesota in terms of medicine, but it's much, much broader than that. The biosciences and biotechnology, genomics, nanotechnology, bioinformatics, and the like have enormous implications in agriculture, in environmental cleanup, in industrial applications, animal health. We have some examples of how this can be applied and help greater Minnesota in a whole variety of ways. Dow Cargill is actively working on plates and silverware and clothing and linens and curtains that are all made out of soy or corn fiber. When you feel and touch them, they're almost indistinguishable from high-quality cotton or other high-quality fibers. We have examples of rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota companies that are trying to position themselves in this space. That would include I think it's Hawthorne. I'm trying to remember the name of in the Worthington area. There's a company that is is helping to occupy the space and is growing. So it's not a University of Minnesota or Human Health Initiative only. I think it's Newport Labs, if I recall correctly, in Worthington. But it's not just the University of Minnesota. It has enormous implications for a whole range of human activities, economic activities, and it's going to revolutionize so many of these areas over the next 10 or so years. We also announced this week a white-collar crime task force, which will encourage cooperation between federal, state, and local government on prosecuting white-collar crimes and financial crimes. You're seeing an increasing need for this because of computer crime, internet crime, more sophisticated forms of white-collar crime. In order to prosecute them, they need sophistication, we need expertise, we need focus, and so this task force would be a focal point, a coordinating point for all of these law enforcement resources to bring to bear in these white-collar crime areas. We've made some progress on Prairie Island. Announced a couple weeks ago that I had some minimal expectations for what a Prairie Island bill would look like. That really featured increased commitments to renewable fuels and alternative energy in exchange for allowing the nuclear power plant to continue for a reasonable period of time, and spoke of the need to transition or at least diversify our energy production capabilities in Minnesota. Those expectations have been well received in the Senate. We had a little bit of a detour in the House yesterday, but we hope to bring that bill together in a way that we'll get it concluded during the session. This morning we've had some extensive discussions about the profile of learning in the education area. We're getting closer to a deal on the profile of learning, although that discussion continues, but we're hopeful about that. And there are many, many others, but I think rather than me going on about what I think is of interest or important over the last week or two, I'd be happy to take your questions or inquiries about those issues or anything else you'd like to talk about. But thank you for joining us, and we'll throw open the phone lines for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone, and you will be announced prior to asking your question. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, if you have any question, please press star 1. Our first question is from Matthias Baden from the Free Press.
Governor, could you describe a little bit about what it's like negotiating with Senator Hottinger?
Well, Senator Hottinger is somebody I've known for many years. Even before I was in the legislature, I had some dealings with him, and he has strong convictions and a strong sense of his philosophy. But he's a gentleman in the sense that we can have strong feelings and be strong advocates for our positions, but we both recognize that you don't need and shouldn't be a jerk about it. And so you can have disagreements, but that the level of interaction and discussion should be civil. And we need to keep in mind that it's not about his emotions or my emotions. It's about trying to get something good done for Minnesota, even though we may disagree on how to best do that. And so he's a real gentleman. I think he's leads with a great deal of class and maturity. And I enjoy working with him. Again, that's not to say we agree, and it's not to say that the negotiations are easy. They are very difficult, but the tone of it is always civil on both sides, and I respect Senator Hottinger very much.
Our next question is from Kirsty Marone from the St. Cloud Times.
Hi, Governor. Could you tell me, now that you've had a chance to study the most recent report regarding the North Star Corridor, has your position on that project changed at all, and is there any chance of finding any funding for it this year?
Yeah, I've carefully studied the most recent study by Anton and Associates, which was commissioned by some of the advocates, and I've sat through a formal presentation up, I think it was in Elk River or Anoka, by Mr. Anton, and also had him into my office to brief me on it in more detail, and I've read it, and I'm impressed with it. I have also asked for information from the Federal Transit Authority, the FTA, which was delivered to me yesterday. Actually, it was produced by the FTA earlier, and I received my copies of it yesterday. I'm going to be going through that as well. I am open to considering the North Star Corridor, but I want to go through the FTA data. You know, they have taken a much more aggressive and critical assessment of these transit projects in recent years, and I want to see what they think about it. They're, you know, here locally, we have everybody's who's got their own agenda or perspective on it comes up with their own consultant, and surprise, surprise, their numbers support their perspective, and that includes some of the opponents as well. And so I think the FTA is a good, neutral, third party and increasingly critical eye that we can use to help evaluate these projects. But I am not going to say that I would veto North Star. Certainly, I am open to it and want to look at the FTA data and maybe some others before I make any final decision.
Our next question is from Casey Howard from Murphy McGinnis News.
Governor, you've extolled the jobs program as a major economic stimulus package. Do you prefer the Senate version as Senator Bach has amended it, or do you prefer the House version? And are you concerned that it's currently not in the Senate tax bill?
Well, I prefer the House version, but you know we realize you got to compromise in this process, so we're hoping the House and Senate versions could be blended at a minimum, and maybe even more the House version prevailing. We also have a bioscience bill that's similar to the Job Z bill that we want to get passed also. I'm concerned they didn't put it in the Senate tax bill. I hope all that means is that they realize it's important to me and they want to try to hold me up, not because they disagree with the bill, but because they know I want it, and so they're trying to kind of hold it hostage, and that's fairly typical around here, unfortunately. But it's important, and I think most people who are opposed are DFL legislators, and I've been out in these communities talking to their economic development directors and mayors and city council and county folks, and for the most part, there's great support for it. And people recognize, and I concede, it's not a magic bullet, but it will work. And Greater Minnesota needs help. And this is a new idea. It will work. It's worked in other states, and we can even learn from some of the experiences in those other states and make it work even better in Minnesota. And so I am disappointed that perhaps there's some politics going on. I think we should rise above that, and I applaud Senator Bach for his authorship, but for the others who are kind of holding it hostage in the Senate, we shouldn't play games when the consequences of that is potentially losing job opportunities for places like northeastern Minnesota and others who just desperately need some economic hope.
Our next question is from Don Davis from the Forum Communications.
Mr. Governor, let's continue on the topic jobs and LGA. Tell us where the negotiations are on issues like this that involve rural, especially involve rural Minnesota. Have you ruled anything out or in? How much have these been involved in the negotiations so far?
Well, the discussion around LGA, Don, is a very important part of the discussions, and I think everybody acknowledges there's going to be some reductions in LGA. And so one issue is how much are the reduction going to be? And then the second issue is, well, once you settle on how much money you have to spend, how is it going to be distributed? And the second issue is probably even more challenging or problematic than the first. I think, you know, there's broad understanding that LGA is going to have to be reduced. But then the more complicated dispute is how do you fairly distribute the money. That's been haunting the legislature for at least 15 years, and I directed the Commissioner of Revenue, Dan Salamone, to come up with a formula regardless of politics. You know, don't look at whether it's a Republican area, Democratic area, just take the best thoughts that you can muster over his whole career of experience on this and put together a good formula. We did that. Some parts of the states liked it. Some parts of the states didn't. I think as a testimony to the fact that we didn't politically manipulate it, we got more complaints from Republicans than we did Democrats on our formula. But the House has tweaked it. It's a very delicate issue, and you know you got to pass a bill, so it's got to be satisfactory to enough folks. And the unfortunate part about it is that most of the Democrats in the House, anyhow, aren't going to vote for any of these bills or many of them. And so we really have to focus on, you know, how do you get enough votes to pass the bill and keep the majority of the body happy enough to support the bill. So the bottom line to your question is it's a central part of the discussion. LGA is going to be cut. We're working on hopefully a reformed and better formula that is, even though it's going to reflect a reduction in the funding, more fairly distributes the money. Some communities will like it in relative terms. Some communities won't. But it represents a more modern, fairer, less political distribution of the money.
Our next question is from Jamie DeLage from the Grand Forks Herald.
Yeah, Governor, I was going to also ask about LGA. Last night, the East Grand Forks City Council passed what one council member called Palenti taxes. It was fee increases in city utilities and library and parks. I want you to talk a little bit more about the future of LGA and whether state aid to cities is justified in your viewpoint.
Well, I think aid to local units of government is justified as a goal and as a program, but I think it would help if people would remember the original intent of the program. You know, it's not just to artificially hold down property taxes, it's to provide assistance to communities who lack population or sufficient commercial industrial property, or I should say tax capacity more broadly, to pay for their local services locally. And so if you have a particularly small or particularly poor community and you don't have the economies of scale or economic resources to pay for your police and fire and other local services, that the state would provide some assistance to level the playing field so that no matter where you lived in Minnesota, you'd have access to a reasonable level of local services regardless of where you live. And so that was the original intent. But now when you go around the state and I will refrain from naming names, but you see growing, prosperous regional centers that have lots of population, lots of economic activity, lots of tax base, and the rest of the state is paying 40, 50, 60, 70% of their city operating budgets, that's unfair. And we can't afford it anymore. And it's not the highest and best use of the money. And these cities have become very accustomed to the money. And so you can't just pull the rug out from underneath them. You have to do it incrementally. And when they say, well, 40% of my LGA is being cut, you have to express that as a percent of their total budget. You know, we had a fight about what is the definition of total revenues, but our bill said you can't lose more than 5% of your total revenues as a result of LGA cuts. We've got a 15% budget deficit in Minnesota, and asking the cities to take a 5% haircut I didn't think was unreasonable in these times. Now, they argue with us about what's the fair definition of total revenue, and we shouldn't include, you know, TIF pass-through funds that they can't actually touch and debt service funds, et cetera, et cetera. You know, even conceding all of that, you know, we've got a budget that we took a bunch of stuff off the table on and still balanced it. And I get a little concerned that the cities, you know, even though we've had difficult times in the state for some period of time, feel that they can take no or very little reduction in this formula and make any changes at the local level. And so we need, the only way they're going to reform is if they get some pressure. This is one way to pressure them. You can't ask really small cities or really poor cities to, you know, take major reductions. But some of the cities, and again, that's why you have to go back and reform the formula, are prospering, are growing, they have lots of commercial tax base, they have growing population, and they're getting a ton of LGA. And I don't understand, if the idea is to provide assistance to communities who can't afford it, why we're paying 50% or more of their city budgets when they're not what you'd consider hurting cities.
Once again, if anyone has any question, please press star 1. Our next question is from Jim Pumarlo from the Red Wing.
Governor, the Prairie Island bill, you referred to the detour last night. Number one, do you think that it will pass the session? And number two, on one specifics, it appears that the big sticking point is whether additional storage should be approved by the PUC or the legislature. I'm wondering if you would be open to the suggestion by some that the PUC, as a regulatory agency, would rule on future requests would be kind of open, like to reverse referendum that could go back to the legislature if they wanted to undo the PUC decision.
Yeah. I don't like the idea of turning the decision-making in this area over to the PUC only. I think there are broad and profound public policy issues that are raised by nuclear storage that go beyond kind of the narrow focus of the PUC. So I think the final decision-making should rest with the legislature and not just in the form of, you know, having some limited opportunity. I think they should have a full and final say in it. So that's my position on it. I think the legislature should have the final opportunity. That's not to say the PUC couldn't initially decide or preliminarily decide, but I think the legislature should have the final decision. The other points really relate to the differences in the House and Senate bill relate to, you know, commitments to alternative energy and in what form and how much, and I trust those can be worked out. But I feel strongly that the legislature should have the final decision on these matters.
Our next question is from Dan Fields from the Austin Daily Herald.
Governor, I'd like if you could share your thoughts regarding the possible reality of tax-free zones throughout the state right now.
Well, I'm optimistic about it. I think even though the DFL Senate did not include it in the bill, they're doing that largely because they don't want to give me what I want for political reasons. But I think, truth be told, most of them acknowledge it's a good idea, or at least an idea worth trying. So I think in the final hours, we'll get that included in the bill, and I believe we'll be able to take in applications for those in this year and get some of them up and running next year. So I'm optimistic about that. You know, jumping back to the LGA issue just quickly, I know Greater Minnesota is concerned about it as a Greater Minnesota metro issue, but please keep in mind the bulk of the money or majority of the money actually goes to the metro area in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the first ring suburbs. And there's as much of a need for reform and consideration of that money as well. So it's not exclusively a rural concern or rural issue. And I know there's also concerns about disparities between the impacts that these cuts or reductions will have on Greater Minnesota versus not so much the metro, like I said, because the metro gets a lot of the money. It's more the third and fourth ring suburbs that I think people are aiming their criticism at.
Our next question is from Mark Fichenik from the Mankato Free Press.
Hi, Governor. I was just wondering, you know, considering that Senator Hottinger came out yesterday and said that he finally accepts that you're not going to go along with any tax increases, if that has something to do with the progress that's been made, is the Senate basically looking for a solution that doesn't involve tax increases now in negotiations?
Well, we've talked about some concepts. You know, but I don't, in deference to the negotiations and the private nature of that, I don't want to get into the details of it, but suffice it to say that if there were a scenario where taxes weren't going to be raised and there was an acknowledgement of that, you know, there would have to be other things that were part of the negotiations to help offset that or at least mitigate the impacts of that from the DFL's perspective. And so certainly those types of things have been part of the discussions, but beyond that, I can't get into the details.
Our next question is from Lenora Chu from the Post Bulletin.
Hi, Governor. Actually, I was going to kind of continue on the question. I don't know if you can answer that, but can you talk about some of the things that are on the table as far as negotiating sort of, you know, carrots? You know, like the bonding bill.
Yeah, and basically everything's on the table with the exception of the tax increases. But, Racino's part of the discussion. Bonding is part of the discussion. Transportation issues are part of the discussion. Fees are part of the discussion. Reprioritizing spending of the money we do have is part of the discussion. Policy language changes that one side or the other wanted or don't want is part of the discussion. So there's a lot going on beyond just the issue of taxes that is part of these discussions.
So what Speaker Swigum said last night about the Racino being off the table in exchange for no tax increases, that's not true?
Well, what I would say is that those two items are certainly part of the discussion, taxes and Racino. But I think, with all due respect to Speaker Swigum, his comments that any of these issues have been finalized or even partially finalized was premature, and I think he's acknowledged that.
Our next question is from Matthew Culsey from the Faribault Daily Newspaper.
Hello, Governor. On May 28th, the new conceal and carry law goes into effect, and you signed it without comment. Can you comment on that now?
Yes, it's an issue of great concern and controversy, but I hope people will consider the data and not the emotion of the issue. There's a lot of folks who just have an emotional reaction to the issue one way or the other, and I understand that. I respect that. But we have to make public policy in large part on good information and data. And there is 35 or more states who have concealed carry laws on the books, and many of them have had them there for a long time. The kinds of concern and near hysteria that some people allege have not materialized in those other states. And so I think people should just take a little bit of a breather and see how this works before they jump to conclusions or make allegations. In terms of my personal views on it, a number of public policy goals were accomplished by the bill. One is we moved from a subjective and non-uniform system where, you know, what people don't realize is we had concealed carry on the books. It was just a very subjective system. You know, in some parts of the state, many or all got it when they applied. In other parts of the state, nobody got one, or fewer people got it. So we tried to make it uniform so that there wasn't a discriminatory difference as to what part of the state you lived in as to when and how you got a concealed carry permit. That's number one. Number two, the bill toughens existing law in a number of key areas. Compared to current law, you have to be older, you have to get training, you can't be drinking beyond a nominal or a reasonable level. Can't take guns into certain places like schools and others, lifetime bans if you're convicted of some additional new violations. So in each of those areas and others, the new law is actually tougher than existing law relative to handguns. Bottom line, though, on all of this is if you look at the experience of these other states over significant periods of time, including studies, scientific studies, particularly the ones that are done by neutral parties, by the way, not just the advocates on one side or the other, it shows that this type of law does not set off the kinds of problems that are being alleged by the opponents. In other words, there's no data to suggest that this type of law creates an increase in gun violence or problems beyond or attributable to the law. There may be other reasons why crime might go up in Minnesota, socioeconomic reasons or others, but there's no evidence to support that it makes gun violence worse in nearly 40 other states over many years.
Our next question is from Jerome Christensen from the Winona Daily News.
Yes, Governor. Would you comment on the criticisms made by your Republican predecessors earlier this week concerning your no tax increase policy, where they characterized it as being extreme, unbalanced, and sounded like they were saying it was un-Minnesotan, essentially.
Well, you know, I respect and appreciate the service and viewpoints of our former governors, but the reality of it is they governed in different times. I mean, some of those governors were coming of age when the Berlin Wall was being constructed. And we live in a different time and a different world, and the economics of the state budget are different. You know, in the last 10 years, we've doubled the state's budget, doubled it in 10 years. That's at a time when the population of the state has grown by 12% and inflation was non-existent. We have one of the highest tax states in the nation. Let me give you a couple of quick statistics that you might find interesting. You know, Iowa to our south and viewed as a very livable state in terms of livability studies. But in any event, they spend 21% less per capita than Minnesota does. And I don't want to say we want to be like Iowa, but, you know, that's a significant percentage. Indiana, which many people view as a you know, a progressive state and doing a number of public policy things that are visionary. They have a million more people than we do, but they spend $4 billion with a B, less than Minnesota per biennium. Wisconsin next door has 400,000 more people, and they spend about $4 billion less in their general fund. And so, you know, Minnesota in these times, if you compare us to not Arkansas or Mississippi, but to places like Iowa and Indiana and Wisconsin, we're not exactly cheapskates here in terms of government spending. We have one of the highest per capita state government spending states in the nation. And as you see in many of these social service categories, even after the proposed cuts, we go all the way from number one to, we fall all the way to number one. You see this in the child care debate, for example. You know, I've people telling me we have the, and my proposed reductions are just terrible and blah, blah, blah. And we're going back to the standard in Minnesota in terms of eligibility for some of these programs, going all the way back to, say, 2001 fiscal year or the year 2000. And how bad was it in 2000 or 2001? So we're still going to be nation leading in almost every one of these categories. And it's a result of and a dramatic buildup and run-up of state spending and commitments to these programs, in large part thanks to these former governors who are now saying, tax them some more, you know, keep up that that pace. And we were on a trajectory to increase state spending by 14.4% for the upcoming biennium. And in these times of war and recession and mass layoffs and historic budget deficits, that is outrageous, 14.4% increase in your state government, our state government spending. It has to be, the increase has to be something closer to the rate at which people's paychecks are increasing or inflation, and that's what I've done with my budget. I propose to increase it about 4%. That is skinny, there's no question about it, but it reflects the times that we live in. And I love those former governors, but the reality of it is at some point in time, somebody needs to bring a little fiscal discipline to Minnesota state government, and they had a different time. You know, and this is not 1960, it's not 1970, it's not 1990, it's 2003, and we've got a different set of circumstances. And we'll take one more question. We have time for one more if there is one.
And, sir, we do have Kirstie Marone from St. Cloud Times.
Thank you, Governor. St. Cloud State University has said it plans to raise tuition by 15% this year, and I'm assuming that other state universities are considering similar increases. Is that acceptable, do you think, and is it what you anticipated given the budget cuts?
Well, it's on the outer edge of acceptable, but the reality of it is the cost of running these government institutions is going up about 10% a year. And so when people come to me and say, gosh, you know, tuition's going up 10%, I say, well, that's interesting because that's about how fast the cost of running the institution is going up. And the reality of it is we have in higher education and K-12 for a variety of reasons, but a lot of it has to do with health care for employees and wages and benefits and other operating costs. The cost of running these government institutions is going up in double digits every year, and we can't keep up. And so even if we provide them a 5% increase, we're not keeping up with the rate of increase of their costs. And so in addition to trying to properly fund them in the future, we also need to ask them to slow down the spending, the rate of spending increases or operating expenses increases. And what you're seeing is tuition increases that are slightly more than the increase in the cost of running the institution. I'm not saying that is a good plan for the future, but it speaks to the need for these institutions to find ways to slow down how fast their spending is increasing. And I don't think when you have institutions who, when the cost of operating them has gone up 10% a year, to have a 10% tuition increase is out of line. And maybe the students, in addition to banging on the legislature for more funding, which is appropriate, they should be also asking the institutions why their costs are going up so fast. Start focusing on that as well. You may also have seen the article in the Minneapolis paper about some of our institutions being half empty when others are bursting at the seams, and there's maybe an allocation of resource issue that needs to be addressed as well. But we are out of time, unfortunately, or fortunately, but thank you very much for your interest in the call and your questions. We'll try to do this from time to time, so I hope you found it to be helpful, and we'll be able to do it again in a few weeks.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may disconnect.